Now listen to me. You are mixed up with an organization known as the Crusade for Freedom. It is financed by an oil millionaire in Texas by the name of Midwinter. Nobody knows anymore, not even the CIA. We did have a contact who penetrated the organization. His name was Kana.
Kana?
Kana. He was to report to me here today with the eggs. You will replace him.
Well, that sounds a little precarious.
Does it?
Yes.
Now, your duties? You are to join this organization, report direct to me. I want a full L141 on this. Use the C30 code. Pull up at the next crossroads, will you? You don't mind walking back, do you, Palmer? I've got a plane to catch.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The United States are blocking help for refugees and medical supplies to Iran, despite what their spokespeople say. An Indian-administered Jammu Kashmir and its 8 million mainly Muslim population are put on curfew throughout its 6,000 square miles. All telephones and internet has been cut off. Why? The state's limited autonomy has been ended in Kashmir, much like Northern Ireland or Catalonia. Half a million Indian soldiers are now occupying the province. That's one for every 15 Kashmiris, turning the state, which went to India in 1947 via Mountbatten, with fake promises of a referendum, into a powder keg. Some say Mountie deliberately left Muslim Kashmir to Hindu India as a time bomb for the future. So, tonight, Kashmir is a vast prison camp, three times the size of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and with double the population. And like the Rohingyas down the road in Burma, why is it just the Muslims that get it in the neck? Modi's move is a provocation to China's interest in the region too, and Pakistan and India are both nuclear-armed states. Plus, tonight we take a look at alternative therapy specialists, alternative treatments for Alzheimer's and cancer, both up against the pharmaceutical industry, health campaigners say, is only interested in shareholder profits. And the UK regulators NICE and MHRA, have they been captured by Big Pharma? Who've managed to manoeuvre Glaxo and Merck's pliable puppets onto their boards. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, or PRSC Radio, no, BCFM it's on, Tuesday at noon. This week, Paul Tanner, convener of Leavers of Bristol Social Group, their concerns about lack of democracy in Brussels were considered too boring for the Bristol Post, despite political editor Kate Wilson having interviewed seven of them for several hours. No article ever appeared. Also, the secrets of the Cullum Laboratory Fusion Project. We speak to a chap whose dad at Ricardo Engineering helped Frank Whittle design the jet engine in the 1940s. Plus, filmmakers Wart Wadsworth on West Indians in World War II and Eshan Koshbakht on Iran's pre-revolutionary carry-on films. Very different films they're making. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that programme right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we have to start in Kashmir, don't we, really, because this is an astounding decision at the beginning of the week. Although anyone who is following Modi and the Indian elections closely will have seen this one coming. It was part of his election campaign that he was going to do this, and actually Kashmir was intimately involved in how he got elected in the first place.
Well, yes, because there was the bomb attack on the Indian soldiers, and then he sent his planes over to try and bomb inside Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, and then one of their pilots was shot down, and Imran Khan handed it back. I mean, it's very dangerous stuff.
I mean, surely it's Imran Khan that should be red-faced here, because it was the Indian soldiers that were killed has been blamed on people supporting his side in this trial.
Well, the Pakistanis claim that they didn't have anything directly to do with it, which is possibly quite likely the case. There's plenty of people in Kashmir who hate the Indian army enough to try and kill their soldiers. And I'm afraid in insurgencies and wars, soldiers get killed. And and of course they don't like it, and they try and react to it. The fact is that most people in Kashmir don't want to be part of India. They've never wanted to be part of India. And this really brings the whole question, is a country a democracy? India is a democracy, after a fashion, but of course Kashmir is included in that against its will, and that's always been the problem.
Now, I did refer to Mountbatten and the decision, and Nehru, apparently the first, would he be president or prime minister of India? He said there was going to be a decision, a referendum, a bit like our Brexit referendum, I suppose, in Kashmir, as to whether they wanted to go with India or Pakistan. Quite clearly that would have been, I mean, since it's a Muslim majority, they would have wanted to go with Pakistan.
Clear they might have voted to be independent of both countries, actually. There's quite a strong sentiment in Kashmir for complete independence from both countries.
Don't you think this was set up? I mean, I certainly think it looks to me as if this was set up to fail, this whole situation.
Well, the history of what happened in that particular era is very convoluted. Britain left India in a terrible mess, and as largely responsible for the mess. I mean, don't forget, in the 19th century, Britain destroyed the Indian cotton industry, and there's recent studies, I can't remember who wrote it, pointing out India was a major factor in Britain's industrialisation, and there was a huge sucking of resources from India to Britain. We're still at the mess. The problems in India today are very largely to do with the British.
But that had nothing to do whatsoever with this decision by Mountbatten to draw the border where we did. I mean, we saw the same sort of thing going on in the Middle East, didn't we?
Yeah, well, Britain has partitioned quite a lot of countries around the world, I think you'll find. We partitioned Israel-Palestine, we partitioned India, we partitioned Ireland, and of course conflicts continue in those countries as a result of the glorious British Empire, of which we're also proud. And we want to relive it now by going it alone and Brexit.
You really think that that's the reason that people voted for Brexit?
No,
because they believe in the British Empire?
No, I think some people...
Or are you just making a cheap point?
No, I think people like Jacob Rees-Mogg do believe in the British Empire. He's just written a whole book about how great the British Empire was. So don't try and, you know, that's definitely the case in his case, certainly.
What about Kashmir tonight? It's basically a prison camp. A lot of people weren't able to go to mosque today. I mean, these are basic human rights now, which are being
There's been 30,000 people killed in an ongoing insurgency in Kashmir, and these kind of tactics won't resolve that. In fact, it's quite likely to provoke further conflict, and that's the problem with it.
Well, isn't that maybe why it's happened, why Modi's done
this?
Because actually he's found that the conflict with Kashmir is actually very good for his power, you know, people sort of, he's seen as a strong leader. He's creating this problem in the first place.
Well, the problem's there in the first place before Modi came along, but he's not doing anything much to help it. I think that all over the world we are seeing these kind of conflicts about identity, nationality, borders are hotting up because the economic situation around the world is increasingly fragile, and politicians of all stripes are virtually unable to offer people anything positive in terms of we can improve your lives, but we can certainly blame those people over there because they started
now,
it, etc.
Kashmir is not just Kashmir. There's also a Pakistani part of Kashmir.
Yeah.
It's Jammu Kashmir, which is the Indian part, even though that is also a Muslim majority part. Why didn't Mountbatten just draw the line between the Hindu parts of the country and the Muslim parts, Martin?
Because it's virtually impossible to do. There's more Muslims still living in India now than live in the whole of Pakistan, because it's a very mixed country. There was pressure from Jinnah to have a separate Muslim electorate, and the British, for their own reasons, encouraged a divide-and-rule strategy vis-a-vis the Congress by encouraging Jinnah to undermine them by demanding Muslim-only majority areas to secede. Now, whenever you try and do this, as in Yugoslavia or anywhere else, it's extremely difficult to do. The border in Northern Ireland is the six counties of there was originally nine counties of Ulster, six counties were carved out, and there was going to be a referendum there. They were going to draw a border based upon the actual, as happened in Silesia, between Poland and Germany after World War One. You can draw a border and then you have a referendum, but there's population movements and there's still a lot of people killed.
Comparison to Gaza and the West Bank, but it's actually Kashmir, this part of Kashmir is three times the size, with double the population.
Well, it's the same. You've got there are similar features to all of these kinds of conflicts all around the world, but of course each particular conflict has got its own unique geography, and one would hope that by solving these conflicts as we seem to have done in Ireland over the past years, a model begins to develop where
painted, all these three we've talked about, whether it's Northern Ireland, whether it's Palestine, Israel, or this one with India, Pakistan in Kashmir, they're painted as a religious conflict. Actually, there's a bit more to it than that, isn't
there? Well, I mean, religion is one part of people's identity. And of course it can be that's what people are fighting about. Some people, the Tamil Tigers were not very religious at all, but they were very, very, very keen to have a Tamil-only state in the north of Sri Lanka, because of course many Tamils were brought over by the British during the empire to work on plantations that they created. So if you actually look around the world, you will see that many of the conflicts that are going on are post-colonial conflicts as part of what Britain...
But this one doesn't really need to happen. Modi, why did he do this?
Well, no, it does need to happen if Modi wants to do what he wants to do. You've explained why he's done it. It's because it's a way of trying to gain power within India as a whole. And, of course, there is actually a lot of mileage in creating enemies.
So why are Indians so behind it? It's a massive support for this.
I think it's pretty silly, to be honest with you. If you wanted a Hindu India, the last thing you need is a Muslim majority province. You might as well just get rid of it. But of course, they never think like that. Everybody thinks, no, we want the lot.
Let's hope this whole process is not going to be about getting rid of Kashmir. But anyway, I would have thought, I haven't seen very good commentary on the Western mass media about this, but Al Jazeera done actually quite a good piece about it. So let's have a listen now to, this is Akbar Haider, who did a report for Al Jazeera's Inside Story earlier this week.
Pakistan has condemned India's decision, and as Kamal Haider reports from the Pakistan administered side of Kashmir, there have been protests over the issue.
Tensions are once again running high along the line of control that separates Indian and Pakistani administered Kashmir. The Pakistani military has accused Indian forces of using cluster munitions against heavily populated civilian areas, which they say is against the Geneva Convention. Pakistan is also angered by India's unilateral move to change the status of Jammu and Kashmir. There have been demonstrations in all major cities of Pakistan, including here in Muzaffarabad, the administrative capital of Pakistani-administered Kashmir. The Pakistani Parliament is going to hold a joint session on Tuesday to discuss this grave crisis. Pakistan has already held an important meeting of its military and civilian leadership under the auspices of the Pakistani Prime Minister. The message is quite clear that Pakistan is ready and capable to meet any Indian adventure. Pakistan also wants the international community to play its role in defusing this crisis, because India insists that this is a bilateral issue. However, the bilateral talks between the two countries have come to a deadlock, and therefore international mediation is absolutely necessary in order to avoid a major crisis from spinning out of control. This is Kamal Haider for Inside Story.
An international mediator. Trump apparently has suggested that he might be such a person.
Modi was very unhappy about that. Because Trump, of course, doesn't really understand the nuances. And he said, well, I'll mediate. And, of course, Modi doesn't want him to say that. But, of course, that means that Modi then thinks in terms of, I'm not very happy with Trump, maybe I'll talk more nicely to Putin and Xi Jinping.
Surely these sorts of restrictions, like no communications, not being able to travel, this sort of thing within Kashmir, are totally counterproductive. It's just going to really resolve the local people there to be very, very anti-India, anti-Modi, and to put on demonstrations that where they may get shot by the massive number of soldiers, Indian soldiers there.
Yeah, and of course young people may decide instead of just going out to be shot, they may try and kill some Indian soldiers. That's what happens in these conflicts.
What do you think is going to happen with this, though? Because it doesn't seem, I would imagine, you know, even in a few months, this is not going away.
No, it's not. It's just adding to the general tension, because we've got tension in Iran, we've got trade tensions with China and China and the US. We've still got a potential war in Ukraine. All of these things have been building up for years, and of course what could happen is all of these little brush fires are going to turn into one great big one. It's definitely possible, and very worrying.
What about Imran Khan and his reaction to it?
Well, he's done what you might expect. He said, "Well, we're not happy with this at all, and we're going to take steps to try and counter it." You know, there's basically been a status quo of Kashmir having some kind of autonomy within India, which was basically a kind of halfway house to try and head off demands for full independence. And by Modi removing that, he's radicalised the situation. And it's the same with the Israelis, with their moving of the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and annexing the Golan Heights. You can do it, but what you've done is you've forced the other side to take stock and decide that they're going to have to fight because their backs are on the wall.
Some say China is beginning to bite back, though. The Dow closed 760 points lower at the beginning of the week, and the worst day of 2019.
Yep.
It does certainly look as if the US stock market is suffering. The Chinese are beginning to get rather annoyed about this Huawei dispute, and they're starting to fight back, biting back.
Yeah, well, I mean, this obviously the people in the stock markets are most worried about this China-US trade war. That's got the potential to bring down the global economy, no doubt about it. And of course, it could well be that instead of stressing about Brexit come Halloween, we're going to be worrying about a stock market meltdown and nuclear war in the Indian subcontinent with the real world.
Cheerful as ever, Martin, but I mean, you know, you're always being very pessimistic and negative about these things.
Well,
but at the end of the day, surely a trade war is designed to actually fend off a real war. That's what they're saying, is look, here's a warning sign.
No.
Economically, no?
No, what happens with trade wars is they escalate into real wars. And if you look at the run into World War I and World War II, that was definitely what was going on. So the collapse of the capitalist system, if I can call it that, in 2008 is really underlying everything that's happening around the world. It's fundamental. And of course people get obsessed with all of kind of what I call epiphenomenon, the things that it seems to be about. It's about Kashmir, it's about Israel, it's about Brexit. In actual fact, the real problem underlying all of this is that the banking system is teetering on the brink of collapse, and when it goes down, people won't say, oh, let's reform things and try and make things better. They're all going to turn on each other like rats in a trap. It's definitely on the cards.
But actually, it's not going to be like that, is it? Because as this sort of thing happens, people start to, you know, various alliances start to settle out. And people say, well, actually, someone else is watching my back, and we're part of a much bigger alliance you didn't realise.
Well, that's what's happening. The big alliances are there because the US attempt to dominate the world economically and Israel's attempt to dominate the Middle East militarily are bound to lead ultimately to war. There are already people dying. Perhaps a million people have died in Iraq since we stupidly went in there with the Americans all those years ago. And there's no end in sight. And do you remember we were told it was going to be a cakewalk, and everybody who said it was not going to work was just being silly. And once Saddam Hussein was gone, it would all settle down. Didn't happen.
Well, we reported last week the United Nations saying that in Afghanistan, that most of the civilians were being killed by the NATO occupying forces, and lo and behold, this week, while the peace talks are going on, I think it's in Doha, isn't it, in Qatar, in the Gulf States, that there's a massive bomb in Kabul, apparently planted by the Taliban, and it's as if they're trying to catch up with the casualty figures: 14 dead and 145 people injured in a Taliban. A massive Taliban bomb attack in Afghanistan this week, Martin.
Well, the way the Taliban tried to finesse this, they said we were going after a military target, i.e. a police station, but it's actually in a Shia-dominated area of Kabul, so most of the civilians who were hurt are Shia. Now, this is not very encouraging at all. If the Taliban want to, if they want credibility, they've got to try and kill soldiers, not civilians. I know it sounds terrible, but of course what happened in Kashmir, which got Modi going, was 40 soldiers were killed. And I'm afraid I've got much less sympathy for soldiers being killed, British or otherwise. If you're a soldier, so, that's what you're there
but
for.
But the question is always, who killed those soldiers? Who killed these civilians? These bomb attacks are immediately blamed on somebody. Who actually is behind them?
Well, in actual fact, the Taliban have claimed this one, okay? Now, and that's what the Parisian IRA always used to do. P. O'Neill would issue a statement saying, yes, we did this. So that makes sure that everybody knows who did it. Even when they did something stupid like blowing up Birmingham pubs, the IRA immediately put their hands up and said, yes, that was us. And the reason for doing that is so that everybody gets a clear idea of what's actually going on. Because as you well know, there are false flag attacks where people are killed.
But then
some people are blamed, but they're not the ones
like
who've done it.
Things like site intelligence, don't we, that say, yes, this was ISIS, when actually it was nothing of the sort.
Well, we don't know. And what's ISIS anyway? I mean, ISIS is funded by the Saudis. Everybody knows that. And the Saudis are our allies and we've got our military embedded with them.
So we're getting into, I suppose we stray into this territory week after week, don't we, which is propaganda, really. And what do you believe and what don't you believe? And why is it that the mass media only seem to check the facts when it suits them? This week we hear in The Guardian that the army is fighting fake news, that's the British army, with propagandists and hackers in one unit. Cyber and intelligence experts unite to battle disinformation as character of warfare changes. Now, this is really, this is by Dan Sabah. S-A-B-B-A-G-H. I'm not quite sure how that's supposed to be pronounced, but anyway, he's The Guardian's defence and security editor, apparently. And he's really, this is almost like a Ministry of Defence press release, cut and pasted into The Guardian. Computer hackers and propaganda specialists, he says, working in the, or maybe the army says this, and he's just cutting and pasting it, working in the British Army, are to be placed in a single division as part of a reorganisation designed to reflect a belief that the boundary between peace and war has become increasingly blurred. What do you make of that sentence?
Well, what's happening is that
We heard of Brigade 77.
Brigade 77.
This is the 6th Division, so we're getting bigger. More and more resources is being ploughed into this.
What's happening in modern warfare is mostly about managing perceptions. That's how they perceive it. That's how they perceive it. And so when they say disinformation, they mean people like us. Yeah, so they've got all these resources, these military people, and they will be pushing a line that we've got to stop Assad killing his own people, for example, when in actual fact it's quite clear that it's the terrorists we've been supporting who've been killing most of the people in there. But of course that's not the line that they're taking. And of course if we take an opposite line, then they're going to try and discredit what we're saying. And of course they're paid by the government to do this. And as we know, when it was uncovered not long ago, the state, this undercover organisations whose names have escaped my mind for the moment, and they were basically spreading propaganda against Jeremy Corbyn.
The Integrity Initiative.
The Integrity Initiative, which is so Orwellian. So the Integrity Initiative is actually spreading propaganda against Britain's enemies, including Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition.
Well, it's spreading
paid for by the taxpayer.
Integrity Initiative spreading lies.
Yes.
Was the other one. Yeah, carry on with this article in The Guardian. Fascinating. The cyber and intelligence experts will be consolidated into a reborn 6th Division, one of three in the army with a strength of 14,500, which will also contain ground troops who can be used in secret special forces type operations.
Oh, what, like assassinating Skripal and stuff like that, eh? Or maybe just getting rid of people we don't like in Syria.
Or potentially here too. Lieutenant General Ivan Jones, commander of the British Field Army, said the plan reflected the fact that the character of warfare continues to change. The boundaries between conventional and unconventional warfare have become blurred. Well, he's certainly right about that, isn't he?
Yes, and of course things like the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980 by NATO operatives and the bringing down of the Twin Towers by the intelligence services of the West are clearly part of a psychological warfare.
I mean, if you were an Orwellian bent, you would say this was rather a sharp end of a police state.
We're already there. People are under the delusion that there's a kind of democracy, but in actual fact, there's an oligarchy ruling things behind the scenes, and they've got private armies and real armies that are paid for by the taxpayer.
The British Army will say that the Russians, the Chinese, are all using disinformation. They're all using cyber war and propaganda. So why shouldn't we?
Well, in actual fact,
we have to. Don't
no,
we?
No, no, no. In actual fact, the other side are responding to our. Way of doing things. I'm not saying that they don't take countermeasures, but at one stage, I can't remember a couple of years ago now, Tory MP was talking about how we could wreck the Moscow underground by cyber attacks, and that's a useful way to punish them for what they've been doing in Ukraine. Although, of course, in Ukraine, the shootings in the Maidan Square that began the whole coup were actually carried out by mercenaries being orchestrated by an American military officer. And then, of course, we blame the Russians for this. That what's going on is a massive increase in the military's belief in using propaganda to try and steer people's.
But it's not just the ideology. British doing this, is it?
It's not just the British. But the key to all of this is the terrorist infrastructure that was created by NATO from the 1940s onwards. Don't forget that Russia and China have been moving in a more liberal direction. Away from a more authoritarian state. Mao Zedong and Joe Stalin are dead, thank God, whereas we're moving in the opposite direction. And of course that's because there is a threat of a multipolar world order in which the West doesn't control everything. The Israelis wrote a book about how many rise up and kill first, where they boast about all the assassinations they've carried out around the world, even though assassinations are illegal. You could argue that it's just warfare. Well, in that case, there are no rules. And if there are no rules, there are no rules and no crime for mummies when we hit back, isn't it?
The Electronic Intifada has reported that Israeli spies are flooding Facebook and Twitter. This is certainly something that we don't hear about too much. Asa Winstanley writing this in June. The Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel is dedicated to a global war against BDS, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement for Palestinian Rights.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and the US Congress has just passed, and Tulsi Gabbard, I'm afraid, has voted for it. It's going to be illegal to advocate for boycotting Israel. So not only can you not boycott Israel, if you advocate for it, it becomes illegal and you can be prosecuted. Absolutely bizarre.
And jailed and fined. And
Indeed. So in other words, we're moving.
So the police are going to go knock on your door if you're campaigning to boycott Israel.
Yeah. And, of course, ultimately, people all over the world are having their backs pushed against the wall. And when you do that, people react. And that's why I say that it's a very dangerous moment, because the chances of this turning into a general conflagration are definitely
there. Certainly seems to be inching towards something like that. But to conceal its involvement, the ministry has admitted to working through front groups that do not want to expose their connection with the state. The troll army is called Act.IL is one of many such groups. It focuses on spreading Israeli propaganda online. What does it do with its $1 million budget? It's run by a former Israeli spy who's argued his outfit is involved in a new kind of war. While Act.IL publicly denies being supported by the Israeli government, the group's chief executive has admitted in Hebrew to working closely with his many Israeli ministries, and in English that his staff are mostly former Israeli spies.
Yeah, well, in other words, the intelligence agencies, the Israelis, the British, the Americans, the Russians, of course, in their own, you know, they are actually very, very active in trying to steer the political outcomes. So we pretend that we have a democracy. In practice, these people see themselves as above anything like that. So that we had a military, an anonymous general reported in the Daily Telegraph or the Times, I think it was, saying that the military would never allow Corbyn to become elected. It's just unacceptable. And we have Mike Pompeo promising a Jewish group in this country, or the US, that there's no danger of Corbyn coming to power because we're going to stop him. Now, in actual fact, that's the real world that we live in. An oligarchy in the West, dominates the politics of the society. It's a bit like the Roman Empire or the Roman Republic. There's ostensibly some kind of democracy, but in actual practice, it's run from behind the scenes by these people.
Insider, just a bit more detail on that group. Inside Israel's million-dollar troll army. This is the Electronic Intifada again. Asa Winstanley reporting. A global influence campaign funded by the Israeli government had a 1.1 million budget last year, a document obtained by the Electronic Intifada shows, even though publicly they deny this.
Well, it's all plausible deniability, isn't it? When they talk about Israeli government spending on things like this, it's actually, of course, US government spending, because every individual Israeli citizen is subsidised to the tune of several thousand dollars a year by the US taxpayer, because they're so poor, you see, they need to be helped.
Through its app, it's got its own little app, act.il, issues missions to the troll army in exchange for cool prizes and scholarships. So for young people, this is great. You know, if you do well in one of these and you get noticed as a troll, you could actually get a place in high school or, you know, a university degree. Mm. The app directs comments towards news websites in support of Israeli wars and racism whilst attacking Palestinians and solidarity campaigns. The Leap report claims Act.il's app completes 1,580 missions every week. So that's over 1,500 different targets, whether it's a news story or whatever, every week, Martin.
Well, the only answer to this...
So the comments, this is the comment section we're seeing underneath them.
The only answer to this is everybody listening to this show, and I presume most of the people who are listening to this show are aware that you're being lied to systematically all day, every day.
So when you
and
see
then when you listen, anything that you hear in the mainstream media is basically suspect.
And I suppose we're including here things like radio phone-ins. So if you're hearing a radio phone-in, that may have been targeted by people like this. So the person that is phoning in, then they have not just heard it and thought, oh, I want to say something. They're actually part of an organised mission. And for example, in other words, complaints, media complaints about programmes, for example. We had that whole business earlier in the year with UK Lawyers for Israel attempting to take this programme down and BCFM down potentially as well. And we found out literally as the results came through with a report from Hillary, can't remember her second name, Aked, was it, I think, from Bath University, showed that the entire thing was a covert operation of the Israeli Foreign Ministry.
Well, so that's what's going on, folks. Out there, what's going on is the government is taking money off you in taxes, our government and other governments, and using it to try and bamboozle you about what's going on. For example, the idea that there was a chemical weapons attack at Douma in Syria, and it's pretty clear that there wasn't, and it's all been fabricated. But on the back of that, Theresa May fired several missiles into Syria. And she was just lucky the Syrians didn't fire back, because if they had, we'd have been at war with Syria, full on, though the whole thing was fabricated.
We're not just saying this either. There's a chap called Michael Beckert, and he's Electronic Intifada. He sent his research to Electronic Intifada. He monitors this act.il's app and posts screenshots of its missions onto his Twitter account. So we'll put a link up to that on our show page. The Twitter account is called Behind Israel's Troll Army. It's at anti-BDS app. That's A-N-T-I, anti-BDS app. APP. So we'll have a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Also, Martin, this whole business with Huawei seems to be getting out of hand, and the much of what's going on in Hong Kong with the protests, to me, I've not seen anybody else talking about this, but it just seems to me obvious what's happening is that China has reacted to Canada's threat to extradite the Huawei chief financial officer to the United States by saying, oh, if you can do that in Canada, we will do the same in Hong Kong. And actually, the United States and Canada have not backed down. This woman is still in custody and may be extradited to the United States, much like Julian Assange.
Yes, I mean, people have forgotten all about Julian Assange. He was basically a political prisoner in this country in Belmarsh Prison. But so what goes on is everybody points the finger at everybody else's bad behaviour whilst trying to cover
up
their own.
And Huawei this week have announced that they're going to be developing their own operating system. for their mobile phones because they've been using Android up till now. I suppose that's a wise thing to do. If you control a phone's operating system, you pretty much control everything that goes on there. And actually, in the world of cyber warfare and information warfare, these operating systems, like originally Windows, Microsoft, MS-DOS, when you invent an original operating system, you can completely control what happens. And this, I've seen evidence that on the 9/11 attacks, that the operating systems were used as a way into the US security systems to make fake airplanes appear on people's radar screens, that sort of thing.
Well, that was part of the exercises going on the day, wasn't it?
Yeah, and anyway, so Huawei are now bringing about they're developing their own operating system. About time too, I'd say.
Well, yes, I mean, it's the whole development of the internet has been weaponized from the get-go by the US authorities.
So is this really about surveillance, or is it just that the United States don't like the fact that Huawei has been such a successful company?
Well, it's both, isn't it? And we're in a very dangerous situation where everybody is basically... when I say everybody, what you've got is... the determination by a declining imperial power, the United States and the Israelis, of course, who are their closest allies, and with us as third in line, to try and contain, you know, basically to run the world the way it has been run for the last 500 years. And of course, things are changing. Countries like China and India and Brazil are changing the pattern of international power. And there's going to be a rear guard reaction to try and preserve the existing setup, and of course that is a recipe for world war.
What about Boris Johnson? What do you think? Is he going to be any better than any previous, or any worse than any previous prime ministers, or is the prime minister really just a front person in Britain these days?
Well, Boris Johnson, we could talk about all sorts of things about Boris Johnson, but basically prime ministers are there to do what the deep state wants. I mean, look at Trump. He's tried to do various things, and if the deep state hasn't wanted it, they've pushed him in another direction.
Well, I mean, he's slowly succeeded in pulling out of Syria, hasn't he?
No, he hasn't. They're still turning. He said he was going to do it, and he hasn't done it because he can't.
It's like Obama with Guantanamo.
Yeah, that's right.
So who is the deep state if they're the people really in charge?
Well, the oligarchy have got very strong links. Don't forget, they've got strong links to organised crime and the intelligence services. So you've got very wealthy people who've often made their money illegal, you know, through the less than fair means. You know, the oligarchy in Russia, obviously springs to mind. They work closely with intelligence services and mass media. And organised crime, the drugs industry, and that's what we're up against. It's like a vampire squid on the face of humanity, as Matt Taibbi called Goldman Sachs.
We also have to look at Iran this week. The Iran sanctions regime, the BBC have exposed, I think it's even just today exposed, is not what it seems. The Americans have said that this is just US sanctions against Iran for everything except for humanitarian aid, but we're finding more and more, Martin, aren't we, that that's just simply not the case.
Well, yes, the sanctions, they're actually boasting that these sanctions are more intense than the ones that were put on Iraq in the run-up to the 2003 war. The Iranians are pretty good at avoiding sanctions, but nevertheless, they are basically killing Iranian children in order to try and change the government of Iran, which was actually elected, perhaps not under a free and fair election, but then, hey, there ain't free and fair elections in the United States, are there?
Amazingly enough, the BBC did a quite comprehensive report on this today, and here is their reporter. He's Paul Henley, and he introduces a chap called Brian Hawke, who's the American representative who is supposed to be explaining all these sanctions, but as we find, what Mr. Hawke is saying is complete nonsense.
Iran says sanctions are preventing life-saving drugs from reaching the country, despite official exemptions for medical supplies. Sanctions were reimposed on Iran after President Trump last year pulled out of the nuclear agreement signed in 2015 between Iran and world powers. The US has nominally exempted humanitarian goods from its economic sanctions. This is Brian Hook, the US Special Representative for Iran. Back in July, in a recorded video message he made, explaining to Iranians what he called the myths about the US sanctions on Iran.
Today, I want to talk directly to the Iranian people to dispel myths about U.S. sanctions that continue to be promoted by the Iranian regime. The last time the United States imposed sanctions on the Iranian regime in 2012, Iran's leaders made many of the same claims it is making today. Myth number one, the United States sanctions medical supplies going to the Iranian people. The truth is that the United States exempts medicine and medical devices for the Iranian people from U.S. sanctions.
But Iranians say there is a shortage of medical supplies and prices have risen sharply. The BBC's reality check team has been looking into how sanctions make it harder for many patients to access medicine in Iran. In a moment, we'll hear from Anahit Shams of BBC Persian TV, who did the research. First, here's Farzaneh, a sufferer of Crohn's disease, describing the difficulties of accessing her vital drugs.
I often have to travel to other towns and cities to check if the pharmacies have the drugs that I need. Pharmacists, sometimes they tell me to get a cheaper version of the drug, similar to what's in my description, or what is produced at home, the Iranian version of the drug. But then there are side effects. It's really, really hard to find what you need.
Well, I asked the BBC's Anahita Shams what other drugs were affected.
They are importing 4% of their needs, and these are advanced medical. But 96% of their needs, they are producing inside Iran. But we have to bear in mind that for producing, they are relying on the base material imported from outside Iran because they don't have the basic material to produce their medical.
What effect are the sanctions having? Because officially, of course, medical aid is exempt.
Medical drugs and medical advice, they are not in the list of the sanction. Although, because of the banking system, and it is very complex, Iranian, they can't have this medical that easily. Let me just explain how it works. The exporter of medical from outside Iran, for example, in European country, they do like to work with Iran. But when it comes to getting their money back from Iran, they have to go through the banking system. And it is very complex because still banking is under the sanction. So although the medical drugs and medical advice, they are not in the sanction, but exporting them into Iran is difficult.
So the amount of medicine reaching Iran has definitely fallen, has it?
It's definitely fallen. BBC has seen an official Iranian figure that it shows that since September 2018, it had fallen significantly. It's about 60% less importing to Iran. Although we can't just say exactly this is just because of the sanction, but because the sanction, it happened November 2018, so we can just see that this is coincident or it has affected to this importing to Iran.
Tell me about the effects on Iranian people. If you have a chronic illness and are reliant on specific drugs, you must be very much affected.
Very much affected. BBC Persian audience, they did contact us. And we have so many voices inside Iran that they are saying they have difficulty to access these medicals. Not only they can't find it, and even if they can find it, the price is really high. They are comparing is 100% more than they were just getting the same medical a year ago.
Is trading with Iran risky at the moment, even if you're a European company?
European company, I have to just say the banks is risky for the banks because if they can't isolate themselves from the US sanction, they have to pay fine if they work with Iran. And so many medical drugs, they can use it in different part of, you know, environment in Iran. So that is why the banks, they don't risk to work with Iran, because if they do and they caught up with American sanction, then they have to just pay so much fine.
If this situation continues, will there be loss of life? Is that already happening?
It is. It is certainly it is, because people, they don't have access to drugs that are life-saving in Iran.
Anahita Shams there of BBC Persian TV. There's another humanitarian problem being created by the sanctions on Iran. The country hosts around 3 million refugees from the conflict in Afghanistan. One of the agencies trying to support what it says is that vulnerable population is the Norwegian Refugee Council. It's the biggest of only 5 international NGOs working in Iran, along with the UN. Jan Egeland is in charge at the Norwegian Refugee Council, and he joins me now live from Norway. Jan, what effect are the sanctions having on your work?
Well, the effect is that we're unable to get money transferred to our humanitarian workers in Iran. When the sanctions became even tougher, July of last year, we saw an immediate change. The banks feared violating the sanctions so much that there was no more money transfers. Then we spent half a year to get legal opinions to convince banks that this would be okay to be done. Then our Norwegian bank accepted to try to get money through, but since they have no office in Iran, they needed an intermediary bank. Since then, we've tried multiple intermediary banks, and they have all given up. I mean, they have, because of fear, because of the risk, because of all of that. And by now, August, more than 1 year since this started, we have still not had a single bank getting a single transfer so far through to our people in Iran.
The European Union is proposing a payment mechanism to try to circumvent this, isn't it? Have you got hope for that?
Yeah, we've had hopes now for a year. I mean, the Europeans have tried, the EU have tried, the Swiss have tried. But there is nothing that is working so far. The point is that banks are not known to be taking a lot of risk for moral causes. They are risk averse. So what we end up with is trying to get money through the traditional Muslim hawala system and so on. But that is cumbersome. It is expensive, and it is not going to work long term.
So all these logistical problems, just tell us what effect they're having on this population of Afghan refugees that you're trying to protect.
That we keep being weeks away from having to close down all work for them.
What would that mean? We've only got a minute.
That we wouldn't be able to help Afghan children to go to school. We're helping with school equipment, with school material, with personnel. Thousands and thousands of the most vulnerable Afghan refugee families would get no emergency relief. They would then be having nothing. It's dramatic, and of course this is not an intended version. I don't think the Trump administration wants to starve Afghan refugee children. They want to shield them. But why haven't they been able to point to a system that is foolproof, that is safe for the banks?
And we'll leave it hanging on that question. Thank you very much. Jan Egeland, head of the Norwegian Refugee Council.
So that was Paul Henley on the BBC. And the little clip with the US negotiator Brian Hook was particularly interesting in that it's quite clear that what he's saying is total lies.
Well, they are targeting the whole. They're basically, it's a full spectrum attack on Iran. They're not making any real exceptions for humanitarian reasons at all. They're basically killing children and old people and vulnerable people in Iran because they don't like the political system in the country.
And they're also blocking humanitarian agencies from the West from doing anything over in Iran now. And of course that means that, for example, these Afghan refugees are going to be a human burden on the Iranians. And that is, surely there's, that is against all kind of common decency, sense, and international treaties.
Well, you might think so, but I mean, if you go back to the ancient world, Rome and and Greece and all the rest of it. I mean, war was total war in the, in that era. You know, you kill everybody and enslave the people that are left. And, we, nothing much has changed. That's where we are.
Anyway, well done, BBC, for a nice balanced report for a change. Fascinating to hear you telling the truth about Iran, which we don't get too much on the mass media. Designated head, we hear yesterday from the Associated Press, Martin, the designated head of Europe-Iran train entity is refusing to take up his job. A former senior German diplomat was due to head a body designated to facilitate European trade with Iran, but he's pulled out of the job after reports he defended Tehran's ballistic missile program. Germany's foreign ministry confirmed a report on Thursday by Daily Bild that Bernd Erbel had informed officials that he won't be available for personal reasons to head the organization called INSTEX. Bild reported that Erbel, former ambassador to Tehran, had given interviews to a German-language YouTube channel in which he described Iran's missile program as legal.
That's because it is. The nuclear enrichment treaty that they signed is to do with centrifuges and nuclear technologies. So nothing in it about ballistic missiles whatsoever. They're entitled to have any missiles that they can build, just as we are.
So he's not being allowed to take up his job because he's telling the truth.
That's right.
How very Orwellian. Bizarre, isn't it?
Well, that's what's going on.
I mean, how is this whole thing working? The Europeans are saying, and Britain is saying, we don't want anything to do with these Iran sanctions, but actually they're really going along with it anyway, aren't they?
Because the problem is the private sector can't afford to break the sanctions, because if they do, they get shut out of the US market, and, anybody who deals with Iran gets sanctions put on them. The Chinese have been told not to buy Iranian oil. Now, in actual fact, they're quite dependent on Iranian oil, so they just said, get stuffed. But the problem is that therefore that encourages the US to sanction China, because not because of the trade dispute, but because they're buying Iranian oil.
But the key take home in that report, for me anyway, is that actually at the heart of all of this is the banks. It's simply the banks are saying, well, yeah, sorry, but we're not going to move any money around.
Well, that's why the Western banking system, which collapsed in 2008, is the heart of darkness. And of course, ultimately, different mechanisms are going to have to be set up in a different world order, where the West can't just abuse the power that it's aggrandized to itself over the last 500 years.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Now, we're going to look at some stories to do with alternative forms of medicine that have been blocked by the officials and by the regulators. Aisha King, what about her case? Then Southampton Hospital staff criticised her parents back in 2015. But now, 4 years later, plasma beam therapy treatment that her son was given is now being done on the NHS. Doctors and nurses who treated cancer patient Aisha King, this is from 2014, have criticised the parents while speaking out for the first time in a BBC documentary. Aisha King was actually arrested, amazingly enough, his father was. So This case, I think, is really fascinating. If you look at it, you'll see, first of all, someone's being arrested for taking their child out of hospital for a particular type of treatment. And then we find that type of treatment is available on the National Health Service 4 years later. And what's slowly happening is that the medical professionals are coming around to the view that that this kind of treatment is possible, Martin.
Well,
is she good for the kids?
Well, unless you've got some kind of technical expertise, it's very difficult to argue about whether a medical
procedure...
Well, you've
hit the nail on the head there. What's happening is patients are using the internet. Mm. They're looking up directly medical reports, medical journal reports, and rather than just being bamboozled by fake news, potentially, what they're doing is they're telling the doctors, well, actually, I've found something which contradicts what you told me last week.
Well, that's all very well, but they may be right or they may be wrong. And in some circumstances, they may be absolutely right. In another circumstances, they may not be.
But it's quite an extreme thing, isn't it, to arrest a parent?
Yes. And especially, I mean, in this particular case, I've only just heard about it now, but if ultimately the NHS itself decides that this treatment is, in fact, acceptable and useful, then that's pretty much case closed, isn't it?
And we're going to look now at the case of something called GC-MAF. Now, this is a cancer treatment, which is... I looked this up recently. I mean, this is a documentary on the BBC. Well, you could call it a documentary. That was 3 years ago in October 2016 on something called Five Live Investigates, where they sent an investigative reporter to show this GC-MAF, which is a treatment for cancer, being sold. And this then there was complaints about this, and the person who was producing this GC-MAF was arrested, and various other things happened. But let's have a listen now back to that BBC Five Live Investigates report from Dr. Kat, actually I can hardly read her name, but it's Kat Arney, who's the BBC Science Programme. From the BBC Science Programme, talking with Adrian Goldberg on Five Live Investigates. And that was on the 18th of October 2016.
This isn't curing cancer. This is maybe slowing it down. There are problems with the research. And it has been tested in some patients, and the people who are proponents of GC-MAF will show you these papers and say, look, we've tried it in patients, this is amazing, it cures them all. And there are very big problems with those papers, scientifically speaking. A large number of them have been retracted. That means they've been taken out of the journals that they were published in because of problems with the kind of patients that they looked at. All the patients that they've looked at have been treated with other conventional treatments. They're using endpoints. They're looking at the ways that patients get better in very non-standard ways. They're looking at the levels of a particular molecule that no other doctors around the world look at. And they're not actually looking at the growth of tumours in these patients.
So if you were to put into layman's terms then the evidence for GC-MAF as a potential cure for cancer, what would you say?
I'd say it's paltry at best.
Kat Arney, we'll come back to you a little later, Dr. Kat Arney. Now, our investigation into the sale of GC-MAF began when we had a tip-off telling us it was available through a shop called Earth Foods in Bournemouth. Our undercover reporter, Ruth Evans, was referred to a man who works there called Nick Greenwood. Ruth told him that her mother-in-law had been diagnosed with breast cancer for a second time and was too ill to travel to the shop herself, but that she had read about GC-MAF online. Mr. Greenwood explained to Ruth how GC-MAF works and why the medical establishment, in his view, doesn't like it.
The medical establishment don't like GC-MAF because it works, so we have to... I don't think there's anything illegal, but they just don't like it because it works and they can't do their pharmaceutical stuff. I expect you know all about that. What the immune system does is produce a macrophage, like a Pac-Man, that goes like that. The macrophage is produced by a glycoprotein, which is GC glycoprotein macrophage activating factor, and it's a D base, so you need a lot of vitamin D. So the macrophage comes from the D binding protein, and that activates the macrophage, and then it goes and just gobbles it all up. So if you just bear in mind that the cancer cell is destroying the part of the immune system that is killing the cancer, that's the part really to remember. The rest is hard to remember and sure. Need to anyway.
So BBC report there, looking at those people who are doing this alternative therapy. Some interesting things said there, Martin. She's saying that the evidence for this is paltry, but that really is just, this is the BBC doctor, but that's actually just an opinion. She's saying First of all, that this cures them all. So, but that is not a claim that is made by these people selling this GC Math. And also, she's saying that they are using non-standard methods and that no other doctors are looking at this. Well, none of those are reasons why this is not potentially a worthwhile treatment.
Well, it's hard to comment on a particular treatment like this when this is the first time I've heard of any of this. I'm certainly buying into the idea that pharmaceutical companies should not be allowed. They have far too much power. The developing countries for years have been saying that they want to produce generic drugs to deal with things like malaria. The pharmaceutical companies have used their power to block all of that. And they, you know, ultimately, if you're going to have a nationalised health service, as we do in this country, still just about, you might as well have a nationalised drug production industry as well.
This treatment is designed to boost the immune system, basically, and help the immune system along, whereas the other treatments don't generally do that. Anyway, let's have a listen now to, and this is something called a macrophage or macrophage, which is being used increasingly in other parts of the world. Particularly, it was, I think, originally discovered in Russia. In the Soviet Union, and it's used over there, but apparently not here. And there was a guy called David Noakes who started to produce GC Math in Britain, and he was jailed. He's now out of jail, and he was going to a court hearing on Monday this week in order to have all of his assets taken off of him. The money he'd made making this cancer cure, well, it's not a cure necessarily, it's a treatment. And so here he is speaking earlier this week. This is David Noakes, and the case being thrown out on Monday.
GC Math is the body's way of curing cancer. It was discovered in 1980, and the government, the MHRA and their predecessors, have killed 2 million people over 25 years by concealing GC Math from the public. If put in the NHS now, GC Math would save the lives of 120,000 people a year. And it is this Southwark Court and the MHRA that are preventing these people from having their lives saved. And we went to court today because they wanted to confiscate my remaining assets, but they cancelled the case. We didn't know, but they cancelled the case, cancelled the listing, and we came to court and there was nothing for us. We treated 9,000 people. There are 300 scientists behind GC Math. There are 350 doctors who have used it, and there are 250,000 followers of GC Math on YouTube. If you go to mhracorrupt.st, that's mhracorrupt.st, if you click common law, you'll get an explanation in two-thirds of a page of why the courts are corrupt, admiralty courts, of why they are trying to strangle common law and failing. And John Smith is the leading advocate with 18 years of common law in the UK at the moment.
So that's David Noakes there, who turned up at the High Court on Monday this week, only to find that the case had disappeared. He was threatening to take all of his assets off him. But Martin, the medical profession, like I suppose all professions, doesn't necessarily like to change. There are quite a lot of vested interests. I mean, I'm not saying in any way that this is some sort of miracle cure for cancer, but it does seem as if the medical profession in other parts of the world is picking this up. I mean, for example, in New Zealand, there's an enormous amount of this. This is perfectly legal, and it's being used as a treatment of cancer over in New Zealand. That's one of the places it's been used most in the world. But here in Britain, apparently no.
Well, all I can say to this is a few years ago, Goldman Sachs were advising pharmaceutical companies, and they said curing anything is not really a very sensible business model. And they were being absolutely honest, because it was a sort of internal discussion, and they're saying we're not in the business of curing anything. What we want to do is keep people alive, but keep them using drugs. And that's what the basic bottom line of pharmaceutical companies is. And if you want to get away from that, you've ultimately got to have a socialised system where medical advances are looked at purely as medical issues, not as a possibility of profit to be made by those who have invested their their money in the companies concerned.
Well, I'm not glad you brought up Goldman Sachs, because Goldman Sachs have been charged today in Malaysia 17 employees over the 1MDB scandal. Prosecutors allege that the bond sales organised by Goldman Sachs were one means for associates of Najib to steal billions. I don't know what currency it is, of billions, dollars. Yeah, Malaysia has filed criminal charges against 17 more current and former directors at three Goldman Sachs subsidiaries for their role in the alleged multi-billion dollar ransacking of state investment fund 1MDB. Prosecutors from Malaysia said the US alleged that bond sales organised by Goldman Sachs for 1MDB provided one of the means for associates of former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak to steal billions over several years from a fund that was ostensibly set up to accelerate Malaysia's economic development. The government in December filed criminal charges against Goldman Sachs and two former executives for breaches of securities laws, including making false misleading statements to investors. Attorney General Tommy Thomas said on Friday the 17 people charged in the most recent filings were charged under Malaysian Capital Markets and Services Act for conniving to commit this significant fraud. Custodial sentences and criminal fines will be sought, they say.
Yeah, but of course Goldman Sachs' personnel aren't actually under the jurisdiction of the Malaysians, so they can say all this, but nothing's going to happen. Malaysia, incidentally, brought in capital controls during the economic crisis in 1998, and it actually worked. And of course, we were talking earlier about capital controls in the first hour. Ultimately, they will be brought back in Britain at some point when we've had a crash.
Why?
Because you'll have to.
Well, why are we going to wait that long?
Well, we shouldn't have to wait that long, but that's what tends to happen is these things are only brought in when there's no other option on the table.
OK, so we've had a look at some of the latest to do with GCMAF, which is a treatment for cancer. Although it's not approved, apparently, by the medical profession. Now let's have a look, and after we've had a look at both of these, we'll have a look at some of the people who are doing the regulating. And this is this treatment for Alzheimer's. And let's have a listen to it. It's called the Bredesen Protocol. And he is saying, in fact, there's a lot of evidence that this will prevent and reverse, even reverse, Alzheimer's disease. And it involves spending 12 hours every day not eating. So here is Dr. Dale Bredesen explaining some of his ideas, and we'll put a link up to our show page to the full article.
12 hours gives you time for autophagy. It gives you time, essentially, at night to induce your ketosis, to clean out your brain. Of course, the lymphatic system, you actually have a change in the architecture of your brain as you're sleeping. You're actually essentially sweeping this stuff out. It's kind of amazing, actually. And so if you're eating with these very small windows of sleep and very small windows of fasting, you're actually doing yourself harm and putting yourself at greater risk. And then similarly, you want 3 hours before bed after you finish your dinner. You don't want to eat right up until bedtime because, you know, your insulin's high. And again, that's hurting your cognition. That's, again, giving you the same sort of insulin resistance problem, storing fat. You're doing all the things that are not helpful. Mm-hmm. So that's the dietary approach. And, of course, you want to have organic. There are toxins in our food. It's unfortunate. We've got a tremendous lifelong exposure to toxins. Of course, Bruce Ames, with whom you trained, developed the Ames test, which allows us now to look at carcinogens. But nobody has ever told us, well, hey, what about dementigens? You're exposed every day to various dementigens, things like mercury, things like some of the organics that are in some of the health and beauty aids, and things like biotoxins. If you're living in a home that has leaks, you are exposed to dementigens, and you need to know about that. So that's the KetoFlex 12-3. We want it to be, it's a plant-rich diet, Mark Hyman called plant-rich as opposed to plant-based. But either way, it is a plant-rich diet that can use some animal products. It's up to you. You want to be vegetarian, that's fine. You don't, that's fine too. That minimizes the toxins. You want to have a high, typically 70% or so calories from fat. And you can start out with using things like MCT oil or coconut oil to get your ketones up. We're finding that people who have higher ketone levels, 1.5 millimolar to 4 millimolar beta-hydroxybutyrate, tend to do better. than those who are down lower.
ApoE4 positive or negative.
ApoE4 positive or negative. Now, interestingly,
really?
For the ApoE4s, what we typically suggest, and this was actually originally suggested by Julie G, who started the website, ApoE4.info, you essentially start with using the MCT oil to help you get your ketosis, but then switch after a month or two to more monounsaturates and polyunsaturates. Now you can essentially balance. So you have the best of both worlds. You follow your LDL particle number, your LDLP. You want to keep it below 1,000. So you can adjust how much MCT oil and how much of the monounsaturates and polyunsaturates so that you have the best heart outcome, the best cardiovascular outcome, at the same time have the best cognitive outcome. Be careful. If you don't get your ketones up and you get your carbs down, you're starving your brain. And so then people will say, my gosh, I just have no energy.
Right.
So you want to use that. You want to basically be changing over to a more ketone-based metabolism for your brain. And then, as you indicated, you want to go back more toward the monounsaturates and polyunsaturates to make it heart healthy.
This potential treatment, well, it is a treatment for Alzheimer's as well, Martin. But, of course, what you were saying doesn't really work if you start to cure people of Alzheimer's and they don't need the drugs anymore.
Yeah, well, I think that's a fundamental. As an economist, I would say that's a fundamental. If you've got a private sector mentality, the purpose of producing anything is to make money out of it. And therefore, they're big oligopolies, pharmaceutical companies. You need lots of resources to set one up. It's not a competitive market, and of course basically they are there to try and sell people drugs rather than to make them healthy.
Okay.
And that's fundamental.
The two main regulators in Britain are the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, or NICE, and the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. Now, what are the odds that these are working in the public interest or the shareholders of the pharmaceutical companies?
Well, what happens, even if you've got independent regulators, is what economists call regulatory capture. So they basically put a lot of effort into making sure that those regulators come out with the results that they want. And ultimately, regulators trying to regulate a private sector market, it's a two-way struggle. They're always going to be trying to cheat and trying to get the stuff through, and the regulators are going to be trying to stop them. Ultimately, if you have it all produced under socialised conditions, in other words, everything is produced purely on medical criteria, not on profit criteria, then you can still make mistakes, but you've got a fundamentally different setup.
Okay, just to wind up this week, US mass shootings. Trump has condemned racism and white supremacy. And this is the Texas El Paso shooting and one in Ohio as well, last weekend.
Well, I mean, it's hard to make comments about, again, that we don't know all the details about what happened in these cases. It's quite clear that the one guy he targeted Mexican Americans because that's what he seemed to be going after. But of course, I'm still suspicious that all of these could be false flags because we've got a deep state that wants conflict anyway.
One of the things Donald Trump said, which interests me, was he's saying a lot of this is to do with mental illness.
Well, it could be to do with mental illness. It could be to do with political, political.
But people who are mentally ill are quite vulnerable to being manipulated.
And indeed, that's quite right. And of course, false flag attacks. You need patsies to be taking the blame, even though there's a more serious agenda behind them. You probably haven't got time, but people who listen to the show regularly will know that the Gladio structures built up in Western Europe from the 1940s onwards were definitely behind lots and lots of false flag terrorism. So when Anne Widdecombe earlier was talking about how NATO kept the peace, didn't keep the peace in Bologna when they killed 85 people, did they?
No, they certainly didn't. Anyway, do you think it's just going to be like this forever in the United States with one mass shooting after another, every couple of months another one?
Well,
surely gun control is necessary over there.
Yeah, it's very hard to do because there's so many out there. it's like stable door horse bolted. The real problem is if there is an economic crash in the United States, there could be a civil war with everybody armed with automatic weapons that they can buy down the local store. It could be pretty brutal. But then, of course, living in Mexico is pretty brutal at the moment for the same kind of reasons.
Okay, well, thanks, everybody. And also thanks to our studio engineer. We don't usually have the pleasure of one, and that is Dave Bazanko here at PRSC Radio today. Time to sign off now, and thanks to our guests in the first hour, Deputy Mayor, former Deputy Mayor and Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Chair of the Scrutiny Committee at Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop, also on the line, Brexit Party MEP for South West England, and Widdicombe. And of course, Martin Summers, you just heard there. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, iPlayer, anywhere you like, at thisweek.oneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'm afraid it won't be a BCFM weekend, though. Our sister show, Dialect, should be back on BCFM next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, oh yes I know. Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, oh yes I know. Oh yes I know, oh yes I know, oh Jesus is coming, oh yes I know. Oh yes I know, oh yes I know, oh Jesus is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Oh yes I know.